Well, good evening, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We're also on the internet at cjsf.ca, where we stream and podcast all your favorite shows, including Endeavors. And of course, you can always find us on High Definition Television Channel 7014. Doing something a little bit interesting today. You may remember a couple weeks ago, we interviewed Stephen Galloway about his book, The Confabulist, but also about censorship and how he was getting involved in the fight with Raziel Reid. Raziel Reid won the Governor General's Award for his young adult book, When Everything Feels Like the Movies, which is about Jude, a gay teenager. And there's been this petition going around by a woman, Kathy Clark, who wants the Governor General's office to rescind that award on moral grounds. And Stephen was so outraged by this that he is joining the fight to preserve free speech and literature and Raziel Reid's book. So we talked to him about that. Last week, I had the chance to speak with Raziel Reid himself and talk about his book and also some of the misconceptions that has been reported about his book. Like for example, both the media and Kathy Clark's petition have identified his lead character Jude as transgender, and that's not the case. He's a gay boy who wears lipstick. So Raziel talks to us about that and the differences between those two, and just the overall conversation that we're having about sexuality and gender and how that plays a part in literature. And so you'll hear that juxtaposed with Stephen's interview that I had a couple weeks ago, and that'll be the show for today. So you'll hear a song first, and then you'll hear an interview with Raziel Reid.
I can't forget a trace of pleasure or regret. Maybe my treasure or the price I have to pay. She may be the song that summer sings, maybe the chill that autumn brings, maybe 100 different things within the measure of a day. Maybe the famine or the feast may turn each day into a heaven or a hell. She may be the mirror of my dream, a smile reflected in a stream. She may not be what she may seem inside her shell. Who always seems so happy in a crowd, whose eyes can be so private and so proud, no one's allowed to see. She may be the love that cannot hope to last, may come to me from shadows of the past. I'll remember that until the day I die. Thank you. my souvenirs. For where she goes, I got to be. The meaning of my life is she.
That was She by She and Him off their album Classics. Just released this past December. It's a very, very good album if you check it out. She and Him is, of course, Zooey Deschanel and M Ward. That song, She. We now get to my first guest. He's only 25, but he's already won a Governor General's Award for Young Adult Fiction for his book, When Everything Feels Like the Movies, which just after the award was announced was optioned for film. It's also the subject of a controversy right now, as there is a petition to try and have the Governor General's Office rescind the award on moral grounds. He is Raziel Reed, and I got to speak to him last week about his book, Freedom of Speech, and everything in between. So, I am here with Governor General award-winning writer Raziel Reed. Hello.
Hello.
How does it feel to hear that, Governor General award-winning? Has it sunk in yet?
Yeah, it's sunk in, I guess. I don't know. I don't really think about it.
What was the ceremony like for you when you actually went up and, you know, were bestowed this honor?
It was really cool. Rideau Hall is so beautiful, and everyone looked so cute in their tuxedos and long dresses, and I got to hit on the Governor General, which is a lifelong dream. But he was a good sport about it. I literally did hit on him in my speech, and his wife actually came up to me right afterwards to tell me that my speech was her favorite. So they were good sports about it. But yeah, it was a crazy experience. It all went by really fast. I was there for 2 days, and it was just a great adventure. And I brought my mom, because I figured I had to bring the person that has, like, thought I was insane for the past 7 years of my life as I've struggled as a starving artist. I finally got to prove to her that I accomplished something with my life.
Well, speaking of that, like, what is an award? You know, there's all these awards for Writers Guild or whatever, but the Governor General's Award, what does it do for you as a writer, as an artist, and what does it do for books in general or writing in general?
Well, I think it's just like a seal of approval. I mean, there's power in those stickers, whether we want to admit it or not. We do judge books by their cover, and we judge books based on an award that they've won. So it definitely elevates you in the industry. I mean, ultimately it's like a superficial thing, but all awards are, I guess.
Speaking of judging a book by its cover, you find yourself kind of unwittingly in a little bit of a controversy. Fellow author, if we can call her that, Kathy Clark. I know Stephen Galloway had some very choice words for her about how she shouldn't be considered an author, but she calls herself an author. Started a petition to have your Governor General's Award rescinded, and nobody is really sure why.
Well, it's because the graphic language, it makes her uncomfortable.
To me that seems slightly ironic, because, you know, here it's Freedom to Read Week, we're all about freedom of speech, and then she's objecting to a piece of art on moralistic grounds. Mm-hmm. When you first heard of this, what was going through your head?
Well, at first I was just amused. Like, I mean, I didn't really take it too seriously, and any headline is a good headline as far as I'm concerned. So I just thought it was funny. But then it got a bit serious, you know, because it is censorship. It is, you are trying to strip a book of its award and keep it out of the hands of the audience that it's intended for. And I mean, what next? Are you going to burn it? Like, it can, if you take away freedom of expression, we lose all freedom after that, right? So it did become a bit more serious. And I'm perfectly fine with someone having a negative opinion or a critical opinion of my work, and if you want to start a petition, like, fine, go ahead. But the wording of it, I think, was problematic. Like, if she had said, I don't think that When Everything Feels Like the Movies is deserving of the Governor General's Award because of its graphic language, sign if you agree, fine. I mean, that may be a little bit hurtful to me, but that's your prerogative. You can have that opinion. But the fact that it was, I don't think that it's deserving, and so therefore its award should be revoked, and it should be kept out of the hands of the young adults that it was written for, that's like crossing a line.
Well, it seems like that she's trying to impose her specific set of morals,
yeah,
on the greater society.
Her myopic morals.
And I mean, as a writer, I mean, obviously when you write something, it's your specific take on the world. Obviously your morals come into play in a certain way. But what do you make of the fact that we have other people trying to impose their morals on a certain set of the population as opposed to the morals of yourself, so to speak?
Well, it's annoying. I don't like being told what to do, and I mean, I don't like being limited in any way, and that seems so to go against the grain of being a writer. Like, if you're a writer, shouldn't you be about freedom of expression and sort of accepting of other people's points of view? I mean, that's what the literary world is all about, so I don't really get it.
And it was funny, because I read the petition, and I read the passage that she quoted, which I believe is from page 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When Everything Feels Like the Movies, and it's something to do with, I think it's the Hemsworth brothers, am I correct, about the characters asking which would they rather have sex with, Liam or Chris. And I almost laughed, because I'm like, that was high school for me. Like, I don't know if you had a similar experience, but...
That was yesterday for me. No, yeah, I mean... It's a teen novel, and it's about, like, Generation Y, and these kids, like, they're selfie-obsessed, they're fame-obsessed, they're so desensitized to sex, like, they're really detached from it. They grew up with sex on their phone, they grew up watching porn on their phone, so it's not something that shocks them, and I think that comes through in their language. They're just really sort of blasé about it. And, I mean, I understand if someone who's a bit older, it finds that a bit uncomfortable or shocking, but I mean, you can't, it's just a reflection of a reality, you know, you can't fight it.
Well, you know, on that note, I mean, even in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years since I've graduated high school, we've seen just so much explosion of social media and this and that and the other. What have you found has changed, you know, sort of between when you left high school and sort of the kids that are in it now?
Well, it's like you said, it's just gotten so much bigger, right? I feel like everyone is living online much more than ever before, and it just increases every day. It's just the new reality. That's how, like, for instance, I used to write a social column for the gay community. I used to go to gay parties and review them, and there's been a lot of discussion about how necessary the gay village is nowadays. Is Davey really relevant anymore? Because the gay scene isn't happening on a street, it's happening on a Facebook feed. And I think that that's just a reflection of our world. That high school isn't happening in hallways, it's happening on Facebook.
You know, and on
and
that
we never graduate.
I mean, you know, and on that note, I think, you know, I think maybe part of Ms. Clark's issue with this book is that it deals with issues that she might not fully understand. You talk about sexuality, there's a transgender, if I'm correct, and that's...
Actually, it's not he's not transgender. That's, like, they really don't understand it, because the critics have called my narrator Jude transgender, and he's not. He's just a gay boy who wears lipstick and, like, likes his mom's hooker shoes, and, like, that's just a type of gay guy. That doesn't make him transgender.
What? And... To pick up on that point, does that speak for a greater need of education, perhaps,
yeah,
maybe not so much our generation, because I think our generation understands that difference, but to the older generation, you know, the boomers, and maybe even some of the Gen Xers, who when they were growing up, this wasn't, I mean, it was around, but it wasn't really talked about. So how do we educate a public that is largely older than us in these issues?
By writing books about it, and hopefully they don't ban them. I mean, I do think it was a learning experience for, like, for Barbara Kay, for example, who wrote the National Post critique of my book. I wrote a rebuttal for The Walrus in which I wrote, I'm grateful that she criticized my book because it taught her something. Now she knows the difference between a transgender boy and a gay boy who's wearing lipstick. Because I think a lot of an older generation doesn't know the language.
Yeah.
And, I mean, maybe younger people don't know it, too. Not everyone knows it. It's within the gay community, even, there's always a debate about, you know, can we use the word, what words can we use, and who are we defining by using certain words? So
yeah.
It's an important dialogue to continue to have.
Well, I want to pick up on that, because I was listening to Q the other day, and they had an educator on talking about the use of the pronoun they, mm-hmm. as sort of a gender neutral thing, and it's something that we've seen picking up a lot of steam in absence of other gender neutral pronouns that have sort of tried to be propped up in the past and haven't worked. What is your take on that issue? Is this something that we should strive to use rather than he, she, miss, and mister? Should we everybody just use they?
I personally think they is really fucking annoying. Like I am I allowed to swear on this?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Whatever.
It's college radio, right? I mean, they, to me, is more than one person, so I don't really get it. I respect however someone wants to be referred to. If you tell me that you want me to call you they, then okay, I will. But I'm happy with being called he, and, like, I don't know. Yeah. It seems a bit weird to me.
Well, I know Justin Bond, who's a great trans performer in New York, uses the MX, mix, as opposed to miss or mister.
Okay.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, is there a need for these alternative pronouns sort of outside of the male-female dichotomy?
I think the pronoun is surface level. What the real need is just acceptance that saying he or boy, that doesn't mean anything, or saying female. Like, what does that mean? We grow up in this world where as soon as you're born, you know, blue is for boys, pink is for girls, and then we're defined ever after by certain things are for certain genders. And so I think that's what needs to change. It's our mentality. It's not the language that we're using. It's the way that we view gender and how diverse and vast and complicated it can be. Gender is a unique experience, just like sexuality.
What do you make of the conversation that's happening around gender these days? We're seeing a lot more trans issues talked about. Asexuality is starting to be talked about. Gender queer, gender fluid, you know, like there's so much more happening in that regard. What do you make of what's going on in that aspect?
Well, I think we're evolving, and I mean, hopefully people are broadening their understanding of what gender means or what sexuality means, and we're finally starting to understand that you can't put someone in a box, you can't just label them, you know. Like, I'm a gay man, but that doesn't mean, like, I identify as a gay man because I have to pick a label in this world. But that doesn't mean that I can't, or could never be attracted to a female, or have, you know, or have that desire. My sexuality is unique, and gender is unique, too.
Yeah.
So, I guess we're starting to realize that more, it seems. Like, there's definitely more of a dialogue about that lately.
I do want to bring it back to the book. You know, they often say that for writers, and especially, you know, sort of first novels or breakthrough novels, it's all about write what you know. And I'm curious, in everything through lots of movies, how much of you went into the story? How much of you went into your characters?
Well, quite a bit. My narrator, Jude, is inspired by a boy who was murdered in California. His name's Larry Fultz King. He asked a boy in his class to be his Valentine, and that boy brought a gun to school and shot him. So that was the first inspiration. And then as I started to write Jude, he kind of took on a life of his own and became his own creation. But I also drew in inspiration from my own life and my own experiences. I think what is the most similar between me and Jude is our ability to dream. I've always was a dreamer. That was like, my dreams were my friends. I was never really like a popular kid. I always escaped through my imagination. And, you know, when I was in high school, all I could think about was moving to New York and going to film school and starting my real life. And Jude, you know, he wants to move to Hollywood and be a star. So that mirrors my own experiences. I guess the need to escape through fantasy.
And that seems to be the case for not even LGBTQ teens today, but just, I think, teens in general need to find some method of escape, whether it's music or drama like myself or that. Did you find that when you were growing up too, that there was just a need to sort of get away from the mundaneness of life, being a, you know, urban teenager?
Well, I don't know if it's just teens that experience that. I feel like everyone is kind of trying to escape in some way. I mean, we talked earlier about social media. That's just another escape, right? I mean, if you're spending all your time on Instagram, you're not really living in the real world. So I feel like everyone's sort of escaping in some way, whether it's drugs or fame or your imagination.
You spoke of earlier about how, you know, no headline is a bad headline. And do you think that this controversy, if we can even call it that, will sell you more books?
It already has, actually. I mean, I'm reaching an audience that I didn't expect. The other day I gave a reading at Book Warehouse, and the audience was made up of, like, women who could be my grandma. And I wrote this teen novel, a coming-of-age story about a flamboyant gay teen boy, and I never thought that I would be reaching, like, one woman, she was like, I could be your great-great-grandmother, and she probably could be. She was, like, 90-some years old, and I just never thought that I would be reaching them, and I think the controversy or the headlines, it's made a lot of people curious. So there's definitely a positive side to any kind of buzz, I guess.
Young adult fiction has always been around, but I think we're seeing a resurgence in a lot of ways, definitely in the YA stories have been adapted for film. Harry Potter, you know, and Hunger Games, Maze Runner. What is it about sort of this time that we're living in that has allowed young adult fiction to sort of be propped up?
Well, I think it's that the books are like movies. Like, not everyone reads, but everyone sits down and watches Netflix, right? And I think a young adult novel, generally speaking, is a faster pace because it's written for an audience with a shorter attention span. So you fall into it immediately. And I keep on getting told, like, people keep tweeting me or messaging me on Facebook saying, I read your book in one sitting. It was like watching a movie. And I think that's a common experience with young adult fiction. And so for people who don't want to invest in, you know, an adult, heavy, dense book, it's an easier escape.
Were you alluding to that at all when you titled it, When Everything Feels Like the Movies?
I didn't really think that people would, that it would have that effect on people, that they would be reading it like they sat down to watch a movie. It was more just the sort of drama of the book and my narrator, Jude, like, he's fame-obsessed and he's so hyperbolic and everything's just over the top, so he makes everything out to be a movie.
Jude is certainly not the only person of his age that is fame obsessed. You know, we're seeing all these reality shows of, you know, teenagers or people that don't really have a talent but want to be famous, you know, whether they're a housewife or a Kardashian or whatever. What is it? I mean, obviously there's a certain allure to that. But for you, what do you have to say about fame and how it can affect people in the long run?
Well, I think that fame shouldn't be a goal, it should be a result, hopefully, right? Like, you should achieve something that you get attention for instead of just getting attention for attention's sake. But, I mean, our culture is kind of just, it's all about attention. It's that internet culture, the social media, it's all about instant validation. And so that's what everyone's striving for. But, and I was no different. When I was a teenager, that's what I wanted. But as I grew older, I realized, you know, I could join a reality show and just be absolutely shameless, or I could post nothing but nude selfies and get a million followers. But that sort of surface level and superficial. Like, what is that going to get you long term? At the end of the day, I want something that's going to be substantial, that's going to last longer than followers will, you know? So a book is something that, you know, will be around hopefully longer than I will. And that's the sort of fame that's worth it, I guess.
Well, that's an interesting point you mentioned there, because, you know, the book store is dying. Like, the chapters here is closing, Barnes, you know. What's your take on the future of the book and the future of the written word as a form of escape and entertainment?
Well, I think the written word will always be around. How people are reading it is changing. I mean, I think newsprint is quickly out the door. I mean, all print is quickly out the door, but I think it'll be newsprint and then magazines and then books. And I think there will always be some books. Like, books are kind of going to be like records, because it's a classic experience that you can't get through a screen holding a book. It's a life of its own. So I think that'll always be around in some capacity. But, I mean, obviously we're moving into a digital world, and that's just the inevitable.
Speaking of books, When Everything Feels Like the Movies is being defended on Canada Reads by Lainey Gossett. How does that feel for you as a writer? Not only that your book is being defended on a national program, but it's the first young adult novel to be featured on this.
I think it's great, because even though a lot of people are reading YA these days, there's still like a snobbery about it. It's almost like a dirty little secret or a guilty pleasure that no one wants to admit to reading. And I think a lot of great literature comes from the YA genre. So I'm really glad and grateful that Lainey has brought that to the surface, and people who maybe wouldn't normally read the genre have been introduced to it.
What do you think she can bring to the table in terms of defending your book?
Well, I mean, she's like a pop culture savant, so that'll help a lot, since my book relies heavily on pop culture references. But also, just talking to her on the phone, like, she is really intelligent and just so bright and bold, which I think will go far.
Have you staked out your competition? What do you think your chances are?
There's some serious competition. I mean, I'm up against the great Thomas King, who I actually met at the Governor General's Awards this year. He won for adult fiction. I don't know. I think with Canada Reads, it's really about the judges. It's I don't know how it is about the books, but it's also about how you're being championed. So I have faith in Lainey. I think she's a really strong girl.
Well, I know the theme this year is the one book to break barriers. Would you say that When Everything Feels Like the Movies has broken any barriers in a certain sense in terms of how we talk about sexuality and gender?
Yeah, I think it's already breaking barriers. I mean, that's like one of the great things about the controversy, is that people it's already educating people on language. It's you know, teaching people about sexuality and diversity and what it means to be different in this world. And I mean, Canada obviously is a pretty progressive country. We've come a long way with gay rights, but we still ostracize people who are different. So it's okay to be gay. Like, we're all sort of accepting of that, generally speaking. But as soon as you are too flamboyant or too weird and stand out too much and go against the grain too much, then you're met with opposition and you sort of scare people. So I hope that the barrier that it breaks is you know, that individuality is something to be celebrated and not feared.
Is it? It's maybe not even necessarily about gender and sexuality, but just about identity.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, we have an idea of what masculinity is and what femininity is, and does how, you know, how identity relates to gender.
That's a beautiful way to put it, and absolutely, because it's not like. I think a lot of people think, oh, this is the gay novel. Like, we're talking about the gay issue here, but it's much bigger than that. It's more layered than that. It's really, it is about identity and individuality.
Well, the book is When Everything Feels Like the Movies, the 2014 Governor General's Award winner for young adult fiction. Raziel Reed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was the song Somebody Loves You by Betty Who off her album Take Me When You Go. Check it out if you can. My next guest is the chairman of the creative writing department at the University of British Columbia. He's also the author of 5 novels, the latest of which is The Confabulist, which tells a fictionalized life of Harry Houdini, probably the greatest escapist the world has ever known, and the man who killed him, not once, but twice. It's a very, very good book. I highly recommend it. He also is a staunch defender of Raziel's book and did a talk up at SFU last week about the need for freedom of speech in literature, particularly as part of Freedom to Read Week. He also did a performance of reading his book with magician David Gifford last week at UBC. He is Stephen Galloway, and he joined me on the phone a couple weeks ago.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you are the author of The Confabulist about Harry Houdini, and I know you have a show coming up at UBC next week where you're reading from the book and you're partnered with the musician and you're talking about magic. What was it about Houdini that made you want to explore his life in fiction?
Well, one of the things the book is about it's narrated by a guy who's losing his long-term memory. And in the place of those lost memories, his mind confabulates new memories. And in that context, Houdini's a really interesting character simply because he's so famous, even, you know, almost 100 years after his death, that when you're reading a book about him that's also fiction, you can't, you know, you kind of have to wonder, well, is this real or is this made up? You know, did the author make up this scene or did this really happen? And that so closely mirrors what the book is about. It was sort of a natural choice.
Would you, on that note, would you say just because Houdini's life itself was a little bit mysterious that your book delves almost a little into metafiction?
Yeah, there probably is kind of a meta element. I mean, I think it's harder and harder to not be doing metafiction just because readers in 2015 are so much more sophisticated than ever before. I mean, people are aware of what a book is and its place in the larger cultural context and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, definitely.
And, you know, Houdini was sort of known as the first great modern escape artist, what you will. What did he do to bring magic and illusion into sort of a more modern mainstream type of entertainment?
Well, Houdini understood sort of the concept of going viral long before even the internet. You know, all the things we think of when we think of Houdini, you know, hanging upside down from a straitjacket, or leaning a straitjacket from a crane, or jumping into a river on a crate, or all that stuff, that wasn't his actual magic show. That was press stunts he did for his shows. And he was kind of the first to understand that you can pay to have an ad in the newspaper, or you can be on the front page for free. No one had figured that out yet, and sort of that's what he's almost more famous as a marketer because of his marketing than because of his magician skills.
Now, given that you're writing a fictional, metafictional tale about a person who actually existed, how much liberty can you take with the life of somebody that's so well known?
Well, there's sort of two ends to that question. One is the ethical and one is the practical. Ethically, I think because this guy was a magician and he himself made up so much of his life, you know, his own diaries are pretty fantastic works of fiction. I think you have pretty much free rein on that count. On the other count, though, is believability. So it's fine that you can make anything you want up, but if at the end of the day a reader won't believe it, then you know, game over. So there's sort of two lines to toe there.
How much research did you have to do into his life, and were you able to sort of dissect, was this a tall tale that he made up? Was this part of his life true?
I did a ton of research. I think I read pretty much everything that I could get my hands on that was written by him or about him. He essentially created a persona and then became it. So, you know, a lot of the facts of his life as presented by him weren't true, but the outcomes became true. It's really hard to separate the sort of creative license he took with his own life with the person behind it.
And he's interesting because he lived almost 100 years ago, and he was famous for bringing a lot of our more modern tricks. The straight jacket, the water tank, especially, is a big one. And how much of what Houdini did do you still see in modern illusions and modern magic today?
Oh, he's still like a dominant figure in modern magic. A huge portions of, say, Penn and Teller's act are sort of in direct conversation with Harry Houdini. They do Houdini's tricks sort of with a new spin, but, you know, with the understanding that, of course, you know that this trick is Harry Houdini's. He's omnipresent still, you know, so long after his death. In a way, no other magician is.
Would you say that there's a difference between a magician and an illusionist?
Well, to a point, I mean, there's different kinds of magic. There's, you know, there's close-up stage magic, and then there's these sort of, like, grand illusions, like, that David Copperfield or those sorts of people do. And then there's this kind of new TV magician, like Chris Angel kind of thing, which is a lot more staged and uses camera angles and stuff like that. So, yeah, magic has really devolved into a number of different subsets.
And next week, you're taking part in this series, Beyond Words, at UBC, with magician David Gifford. And I know you teach at UBC, but how did this night come into being for you, being involved in this night?
Yeah, well, the people at the Chan Center, they have some excellent programmers there, and they approached me about it and said, you know, would you be interested in doing a show with a magician, maybe where you talked a bit about magic and read some parts of the book that have to do with magic, but then we got a magician to do some actual magic, not necessarily the direct tricks, but, you know, stuff that's related to what we're talking about in the book. And, oh man, I jumped at the chance. What a cool thing to be able to do.
And I alluded to there that you teach at UBC. I know you're the chair of the creative writing department. How do you teach someone to write?
You don't teach them to write in the sense that you take someone who can't write at all and start them from zero. What we do is we take people who are very good at writing already and give them tools to get better. I liken it to sort of coaching elite athletes. Like, you can't make someone into an NHL hockey player, but you can take a really good hockey player and make them better. So that's more what we do.
On a slightly related note to that, not to do with Houdini, but I know, I believe on the Friday after your show, you're also involved in a discussion with Raziel Reed on censorship, because there was a petition going around that wanted the government to revoke his Governor General's award for his book. How did you get involved with that?
I was asked by SFU, but I got involved in the controversy just simply because I could not believe that in 2015 we're actually having a conversation about whether a literary award should be rescinded because some people have moral objections to the content. It flabbergasts me to this moment that even got any traction in the minds of anyone, and also that the people doing it were trying to say this isn't censorship. It absolutely is. So yeah, we're going to talk about that.
I find that ironic that the people who are always behind wanting to censor something, whether it's Charles McVitie or people like that, always come back and say, we don't believe in censorship. How would you describe what censorship is and why it's damaging to the development of youth?
Well, censorship is attempting to suppress a work because you object to the moral content within it, right? To keep it out of the hands of kids is ridiculous. You know, it's especially when you're talking about sexual content. I mean, teenagers know about sex, and they know about these sorts of things. And the second you tell them they can't look at it, that does nothing. It doesn't stop them from finding it. The notion that people could read a book and somehow be morally corrupted is offensive to their own intelligence. You know, books don't make people think things. Books help people decide what they think. It infantilizes people to suggest that even if a book were morally reprehensible, that would have an effect.
I find it strange that they're asking the Governor Generals to rescind that award, but Raziel's book is also being featured on Canada Reads, and there's been sort of no complaints around that. That seems like an odd double standard to me.
It does to me too. I can't really explain what's going on in the heads of the people who are trying to get the GG rescinded, other than just they're wrong.
Well, you mentioned that they find it morally reprehensible, and I'm curious as to whether you think, you know, the book is for young adults, but it deals with, you know, sexuality and transgenderism, which we're hearing a lot about in the news, and I'm wondering if that topic makes certain people uncomfortable, and that's why they want the book censored.
I'm sure that is a huge part of it. I mean, there's a lot of other works, you know. Let's take The Hunger Games. No one's suggesting to censor The Hunger Games. That has children murdering each other. I mean, if I had to choose for my kids, I would go with the not murdering option, just as like the lesser of two evils. There's something always about sexual content and sexuality that gets people's knickers in a knot, so to speak.
We see it, you know, we see it in film all the time too, with the ratings board in the US, how they'll always rate sex higher than violence, you know, like shoot 'em up. Why is sex so taboo for people, and particularly those of maybe an older generation, the baby boomers, so to speak?
Oh, I think it's a sort of Judeo-Christian hangover from sort of religious doctrine. It seems to be pretty Western. I mean, Europe doesn't seem to have these issues. It's something our culture started off with. I mean, we often forget America was founded by Puritans. You know, the people on the Mayflower were pretty hardcore religious fundamentalists, and there's sort of always a twinge of that has never fully, I think, left our society as a result. And you know, we in Canada, it bleeds up. We're a lot more liberal about it, but we're still North American. It is fading away, but still, and we're so much more comfortable with violence. The great Moses Zimmer quote: "The only way you can show a breast on TV is if it has a bullet hole in it," and it's absolutely true, and it's messed up.
And, you know, books like yours about Houdini's, or, you know, books like Raziel's, which deal with a lot more, you know, sensitive topics, some people might say, sexuality, gender, what can they teach us about history, about society, about culture?
I think what books do really well is they place us in it. Like, when you read a book, you're responsible for making it exist. You read the words, but the imagination takes over and sort of creates the story. Each reader creates the story. And it sort of has the effect of putting you in the time and place and story that you're reading about, which then lets you make up your own mind about what you think about these things. It's kind of a transformative act more than it is a read this book and be convinced of XYZ. It's a read this book and live XYZ in your own mind for a bit and tell me what you think about it.
I mean, you know, books are certainly not the only form of escapism or artistic endeavor. But what do you think that books give people, over something like live theater or a film or radio or television?
Well, yeah, what I think it is, I mean, if we just take film for a second, because that kind of is the dominant medium, if you take 10 people and you have them all go see a movie, they're all going to see the same thing. How they feel about it might be different, but the actual thing they're looking at is the same. With a book, words are so much more subjective. Like, you ask one, you take even any word and ask 10 people to write down a definition, you're going to get 10 subtle variants. So when 10 different people read a book, if you could go into their head and get a film of what's going on in their head, you'd get 10 different films. They would all sort of be very, very similar. But you as a reader are so much more active in the creation of the story than you are in anything else, which, you know, is hard and requires more attention sometimes, but I think ultimately it does a thing no other form does.
There's always, every year, there's always a handful of films that were adapted from books. If either the Confabulist or the Cellist of Sarajevo was adapted to a film, how involved in that process would you like to be?
I wouldn't want to be involved. Filmmaking is such a different skill set than novel writing that I would much rather the film people who actually know what they're doing be involved. The other thing too is, you know, those two books you just mentioned took 5 and 6 years to write, and I don't have a lot of gas left in the tank ideas wise on those particular subjects. I think it'd be way better if someone fresh could come to it and bring, you know, a film is an interpretation of a book, so someone else can interpret it for a shot.
Both in the book world and in the film world, sort of two, I guess, genres that we're seeing a lot of these days are vampires and young adult, young adult fiction, if you will. Why do you think those two particular areas are sort of in vogue right now?
I have no explanation for the vampires whatsoever. I've wondered that myself, what the attraction of vampires is. I guess they've made them kind of exciting and sexy, and they're not like Dracula, dark, dank, dungeony vampires. They're glittery and they fly and they do cool stuff. Young adult fiction, I think it's just, I think kids, teenagers have always been big readers. I mean, I certainly read probably more as a teenager than I do now, and I'm, you know, in this business. And I think sort of it's reasonably new writing books specifically for them. So I think that the marketplace has just responded to a category that's always sort of vaguely existed.
Whenever authors come up with books, I always ask them, you know, what are you trying to achieve, or what do you want people to take away from your latest project? So I'll ask you about Making Fabulous. What do you want people to take away from this story?
I would hope maybe that people would ask the question of themselves. How much of my memory is a story as opposed to a fact? Does my brain work like a computer, or is it a storytelling device? And how do I feel about this? You know, how am I going to integrate the possibility that my memory might not be as reliable as I think it is into my present-day dealings?
Well, the book is The Confabulist. I've had a chance to read it. It's a very, very addicting book. And Stephen will be appearing with David Gifford at the TELUS, or the Chan Center for the Performing Arts, on February 26th as part of the Beyond Words series. Stephen Galloway, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's our show for today. My thanks to Stephen Galloway, whose book is The Confabulist. Also check out his new book, The Cellist of Sarajevo. My thanks, of course, to Raziel Reed, whose Governor General's award-winning book is When Everything Feels Like the Movies. Be sure to tune into Canada Reads all next week, hosted by Wob Canoe, where Raziel Reads will be defended by Lainey Gossip herself, Elaine Louis. We're going to take you out with Ray Spoon's song off their album Love is a Hunter. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Death by electro. Baby, you're killing me. Death by electro. Baby, you're killing me. I've got what you need, but you don't see it in me. So I'll burn all my feelings in my secret room of longing. Oh, take me out tonight. Take me out tonight. Someplace I can't hear myself think. Take me out tonight. Take me out tonight. I don't wanna know what it means. Death by electro. Baby, you're killing me. Death by electro. Baby, you're killing me. Take me out tonight, someplace I can't hear myself think. Take me out tonight. Take me out tonight. I don't wanna know what it means. Death by electro.